Welcome everyone to episode 9 of the Real MVP podcast, and I'm your host, Modern Vintage Gamer. Now, on this month's episode, I have a very special guest, someone that I'm a huge fan of personally, and his particular YouTube channel, and that is John Linneman from Digital Foundry. How are you this afternoon, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me today. This is should be a lot of fun.
Absolutely, man. And hey, you are very, very special guest that I've been wanting to get on the show for a while. And we have the pleasure of getting you on the same week as a new Half-Life announcement and Shenmue 3 releasing. Who would have thought that was going to happen?
Yeah, it's just absolutely crazy to think about that. Like, it's finally happened. And yeah, there's a lot of big things happening lately, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, and I know that you're currently looking at Shenmue 3 at the moment. What are your thoughts on the game? I have a copy of it, and I'm a big Dreamcast guy, and I've obviously played the first two games, and I will get around to playing it. But actually, to be honest, I haven't unwrapped it out of the package yet. So what are your thoughts on the game so far?
I think it's an interesting product. I mean, you can certainly see the limitations of the budget. I mean, it's worth keeping in mind for the listeners that Shenmue 1 and 2 were some of the highest budget games ever made at their time. And this was like peak Yu Suzuki, peak AM2, you know, Sega giving everything they had to these projects. This is basically an indie project. I don't know what their financials were, of course, but it's pretty obvious that it's much, much less.
Yeah, but if you think about the Kickstarter, the announcement they made, what was it, 2014, 2015, when they came out on stage? Yeah. I think they raised like $3 million pretty quickly, and I would assume that they would have gotten additional cash injection during that development phase as well, because it was a fairly long development cycle from what I know.
Yeah, I think that's where Deep Silver comes in, where they kind of supported the project with some additional cash, you know, but they have the publishing rights for it. Makes a lot of sense. But I still think, you know, given those constraints, they actually did a pretty nice job at creating something that feels very Shenmue.
Yep.
Like, in an interesting way, it's a game that hasn't evolved that much, in the sense that the core, like, game design is very, very similar. You're basically walking around questioning people, following up on leads. It's kind of like, it's almost like a modern graphic novel, kind of, you know, one of the interactive digital novels combined with a little bit more of an adventure game vibe to it, with all the extra side stuff in there. I mean, the only complaint I really have personally is I don't think the fighting combat system is as refined as it could have been. It's very button mashy, but, you know, it gets the job done well enough, I suppose. And the game has its rough edges, but overall, I think it's a fairly nice way to sort of continue the series, and I'm pretty happy that it's out there.
Yeah, the fighting mechanics is interesting, because we kind of assume, because it's Yu Suzuki, that it's going to have a deep virtual fighter type experience in there somewhere. But, you know, I think that ultimately that's not the case at all, but I think we kind of expect that to be in there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what the original Shenmue games kind of delivered, I think, where it was closer to, it was like VF Lite, if you will. Mm-hmm. You had all like the dodging, the throws, you know, the different moves, everything felt very VF. Where here, it's obviously nowhere near as complex as Tekken, but the layout is similar, where you have two punches, two kicks, and you can block, and then you can also dodge while holding block. But there's just not that much to it. It's really just about not getting hit and just getting and hitting the enemy when there's an opening. And it really is just kind of this back and forth, I hope I hit him this time kind of feel. Like, it never really sparked the same sensation I got from the original games. And it doesn't feel like a match for where Yu Suzuki went with his fighting games either.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing for me that's, it's disappointing, but it's really, there's nothing you can do about it, is the arcades, you know, like the classic Sega arcades, the super scalers that you would get in the earlier games that unfortunately are no longer, you know, available in the newer one, obviously because Sega is not involved anymore. But it's just a bummer that they couldn't do that, you know.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how they got the license, I guess, to have posters for stuff like Space Harrier and the like in this game.
Yep.
So there is reference to it. And you see the Sega logo fairly often on various machines.
You also see the Japanese Sega Astro City candy cabinets, you know, the
Yes.
Obviously, you know, it's those Sega cabinets from Japan that they're using as the models in when you walk into the arcades.
And there's a Sega Saturn in here directly. Like when you open up one of the drawers, there's just straight up the Sega Saturn right in the drawer.
Nice.
All right, that's cool.
that's obviously a throwback to the earlier games, because I think there was one in, was it the first one, I think?
Or? Yeah, they had the white, the Model 2 Saturn was in Shenmue 1 in your house. And in this one, it's the Model 1 Saturn. So the gray one, the Japanese Model 1.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting touch.
Very cool. And Half-Life, Alex, so what do you think about that as far as, you know, the reveal and your thoughts on whether you're good with it being a VR-only game?
I mean, I've been a VR supporter since the beginning. So, I mean, I had the original dev kit VR headsets and messed around with a lot of demos and made some demos and just I had a lot of fun with VR. And I always kind of felt like that was kind of where Valve might go with Half-Life in the sense that, we just did a video discussion with Alex on this, but it's like, the idea is like Valve's always been about pushing boundaries with each release, where like Half-Life 1 was sort of pushing games in a different direction, sort of like the interactive cinema where you're actually always active in the scene. The cutscene is not a separate cut per se. You're just there. And it was a very, you're staying in the single environment, like everything was kind of cohesive and somewhat seamless in a way that we had never seen before. So that was revolutionary. Then Half-Life 2 comes around and it introduces the physics system in a big way that we'd never seen before and really pushed PC hardware to the next level. And then you could even argue that the episodes, like just the nature of being episodic, was kind of exploring new territory, even if that didn't fully work out in the end.
Yeah.
And then here it's like, hey, VR, it's a new medium, something else. And there's a lot of potential there, but I feel like there haven't been that many really high end VR games that really show what can be done. But a lot of ideas that exist in other games could be applied here. Like, I still think something like Superhot VR is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. And that just like being in an environment and engaging in combat with all these items around and having to scramble to pick up things and utilize them. And you kind of see some of this in the Half-Life Alyx trailer. Like when you're stumbling around, you're like pushing stuff away on the shelf to grab the one piece that you can load into your weapon and then fire at the enemy. Like, I think there's going to be a lot of that kind of interaction. And if people haven't really experienced that before, I think it's going to be very impactful, especially wrapped up with Valve's like art direction and storytelling. And although I suppose that the Valve of today really is pretty different than the Valve that told Half-Life 2, but you know.
Well, Mr. Newell's still on board, so, you know.
That's good. That's good.
That's right. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'm very excited to check this out. I am a VR guy myself. I think my biggest problem with VR, like a lot of us, is just the amount of setup that's involved in order to play VR, especially when you've got a lot of cables and you don't have that much room in your room to deal with. But I had a great time with Resident Evil 7. That was probably my best VR experience, next to something like Tetris Effect on the PlayStation 4, which was absolutely brilliant. So I definitely dig VR. And look, this could easily be the killer app of virtual reality games, and I'm looking forward to it. I just wish there was a option just to play on a widescreen PC with a mouse and keyboard and whatnot. And maybe some smart modder out there will patch it to make it work that way. But
actually, an interesting idea would be to play it on a monitor, but still use the hand controls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Conceivably as like a mod. I like this idea because you could still see your virtual hands within the 2D game screen, but because of the accuracy of them. I mean, for me, the main thing I'm thinking about is that personally, like, wearing a VR headset for more than like 30 minutes isn't very comfortable.
Yeah.
Like, it just weighs down on your face after a while, especially if you wear glasses like I do. And you're just like, when you're done, you're like, oh, I just got to get this thing off. So that's one of those things that's I've never really gotten fully used to wearing a headset. It's always kind of an uncomfortable thing after a while.
Yeah, it's usually an hour on and then take a break and then come back to it. Like I played Resident Evil 7. I don't want to say completely in VR, but probably about 90% of the game in VR. And I would sit down, and it was completely sitting down, by the way. Like, I wouldn't stand for the whole thing, but I would sit down, play through the game for about an hour and a half maybe, and then you know, take a break and come back. And I guess that's what they want you to do anyway. They don't want you to sit there for seven or 8 hours straight playing VR.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, but I guess with Half-Life Alyx, it's going to be a standing experience, obviously. So, and I do like the room scale kind of gameplay, you know, moving from area to area, if you will, and sort of being able to walk around your personal space in 3D. It's a really neat feeling. So,
yeah,
I mean, we're just going to have to wait and see. If it's the full kind of full experience that we're hoping it is in VR. But either way, I've heard so many people say, oh, well, now I got to get a VR headset. Yep. So maybe it's doing the job.
I'm excited about it, man. Like I'm back on board with VR and, you know, I'm back on board with Half-Life. I can't wait for this game. All of a sudden, this is like at this point, and I know Cyberpunk is coming in April, and we've got a lot of big releases coming over the next few months, but man, I'm pretty hyped about this Half-Life Alyx game, not going to lie.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I guess it just, like, just seeing that again, like, it's, they still have it, like, at least art direction-wise, and, like, there's just something about the look of the game that's just so striking. I really, really like. And you can see all the updates that you have with the Source 2 engine there.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the first time they've really pushed that to the next level. So I'm also excited to see that. And yeah, I mean, the requirements are quite high, though, which is interesting.
Yep.
Higher than usual for a VR game. So
Yeah. That'll be interesting to see how it performs on, you know, medium to medium high standard spec PCs. I've got a 1080 Ti, so I think I should be okay.
Be fine.
Yeah, but you know, there's always that lure of getting a 2080 or a 2070. I'm gonna wait, I think, until the next generation of NVIDIA cards, like the 3070 or 3080s, get announced.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I agree. So I have a question that I want to ask. How did you first get into video games when you were a kid? You know, what was your first experience and first memories of playing video games?
Wow. I mean, it probably goes back to two things. I remember playing, I had an Atari 2600 that was a hand-me-down.
Yeah.
From my cousins, I guess. And we hooked it up on a small, like, 13-inch black and white TV. I played a lot of Pitfall on that thing. And that's the earliest memory I have. But around the same time, I suppose, is when I also played the NES for the first time with Super Mario Brothers and all that. And both of those made an impact, though obviously Mario made more of an impact at the time, I suppose. But yeah, that's kind of as far back as I can recall.
When did you get your first kind of game system, like for Christmas or for a birthday gift or something?
Probably like 1990 or something like that.
Yeah, was that the NES?
No, the actual first game system I actually owned myself was a Game Boy.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I guess I had the Atari 2600 before that, but then, you know, for the NES, I mostly played that at friends' houses, and then, like, you know, the first time I actually got a system for myself that was more recent was Game Boy, weirdly enough.
Oh, Game Boy.
I love that thing. It was great.
I love the Game Boy. I'm a huge fan of that system. So cool. I mean, that's, if you're going to, you know, get into video games around that time, the Game Boy is an excellent way to start, you know, with some of those cool Game Boy games that came out, like Tetris and Mario Land and Donkey Kong and all that stuff. It was excellent.
Yeah, and it's a more capable system than I think it gets credit for being. You know, that it's a potent little machine, and a lot of the games on there delivered very nice, smooth performance and generally feel about on par with an NES game, though obviously with a lower screen res.
Yep.
But I actually feel like the monochromatic or grayscale, I guess you could say, color palette that you have to choose from sort of helps sometimes with the artwork. Like on NES a lot, you know, depending on how it was done, but a lot of games feel rather garish, if you will, with very sharp contrasting colors. Sometimes that works great, sometimes not. The Game Boy had slightly more subtle hues sometimes as a result of, you know, not actually using color. And in a way, I still think a lot of that artwork holds up really well as a result.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the Game Boy, and I did a video run this recently talking about, you know, the graphics hardware and how it all worked.
I saw that. That was good.
Yeah, it's so cool because you've got, you know, a 160 by 144 display, like you mentioned. It's all kind of dot matrix. And then you've got I guess, essentially three colors, right? I mean, you've got the fourth color, but you don't really count that into the mix. Yeah. So some of the cool pixel artwork that was achieved, as well as these like amazing parallax scrolling effects and just some really awesome, you know, demo style effects that you could get out of this little handheld were just mind blowing. And you're right, it's really goes back to the limitations you had with the hardware, and these programs were extracting the absolute best out of it. I mean, I think Dylan Cuthbert from Argonaut was doing, or from Star Fox, you know, the developer of Star Fox, was doing some really cool wicked 3D stuff back then, you know, with some of the games that he was working on. So I mean, these programs were just getting the absolute best out of the Game Boy hardware. It was amazing to see. And it's always
there's this one game called Prehistoric Man. I think it was published by Ocean.
Yes, I know.
I was always mystified by how they pulled off their parallax scrolling there, because usually on the Game Boy you can sort of like make adjustments on a per scan line basis, but obviously with the way that works, it's just a single layer, of course.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not going to have like the foreground intersect the background. That's how it was, you know, that's typical when developers pulled it off. But here they actually managed to have the foreground plane and the background plane sort of intersect and cross over one another. And I'm not really sure technically how they achieve that, but it's absolutely amazing to see.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of those games that most Game Boy, not all of them, some Game Boy emulators can run correctly, but most of them can't. And that will be one of the things that I throw at the new analog handheld, you know, when that gets released.
Oh, yeah.
Because that game is, like you said, it demands cycle accuracy. It has to be cycle accurate. Otherwise, those effects will just get screwed up. And, you know, it has to run perfectly. And I'm sure it will. I'm sure Kevtris is all over this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that game, and there's a couple of others as well that do some really kind of tricky mid-frame scanline manipulations like Prehistoric Man does. So yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of the hardware for sure.
Oh yeah, that the water effect in the Batman Return of the Joker.
Yeah, that's excellent.
In the sewer level, that's brilliant. And I love the fact that they just sort of rapidly flash that on and off every frame, because of the way the slow refresh rate on a Game Boy screen sort of really does give it the impression of being truly transparent to the eye.
Yeah.
But if you play it on like an emulator, you actually see, okay, they're just cycling this every frame in addition to everything else. So it looks very flickery, but yeah, on a real Game Boy, it's very convincing.
Yeah, for sure. So you're a big fan of the Sega Mega Drive. I notice your pickups that you sometimes post on Twitter with the Japanese cartridges. And I always drool a little bit. Yeah, I love your collection, man. I've got a pretty small Japanese Mega Drive collection myself, so I'm always envious of the stuff that you get. But you're obviously a big fan of the system. Did you get a Mega Drive when it was released, when they were out at the time, or did you kind of, you know, get into it later on?
Not right at the time, but after, you know.
Yeah.
But I played a lot of it as a kid, so. Just, you know, I guess 1989 was a bit too early for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a few years later, like 2 or 3 years later, I guess, is when I really got into it. And, you know, I didn't have as many games back then, access to it, of course, as you would now. But a lot of the stuff I was playing was just really memorable and great. I thought I always enjoyed the fast action on there. And I mean, I love Super NES as well, mind you. But there's just something about the Mega Drive Genesis that really appeals. And going back to it today, one of the things I like about it more than anything is the fact that most games on it are very pick up and play.
Mm-hmm.
You hear people talk about the Super NES and all its RPGs and whatnot, but at least for me, I'm not looking to just pop in Final Fantasy VI on a whim and just pick up and play that for 30 minutes. That's not, you know, that's not really what it's designed for.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of action on Super NES as well, but that's just what the Mega Drive's all about. There's just so many games where you can just pick up and have a great time in 30 to 60 minutes, and then, you know, you're done, and it's just, you know, it's walk away happy.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's obviously better shooters on the Mega Drive, and this is not a competition or a comparison, because I love both. And I personally bought a Super NES when they came out, so I grew up with Super NES basically. And then, like you, I kind of was onto the Mega Drive after. Although I had played it a lot when I was growing up with you know, family and cousins and other people in my family that had the system. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think from a pick-up and play perspective, the Mega Drive, hands down, is one of the best systems to do that. You've got a amazing library of different games. You've got the platformers, which you can, like you said, jump in and start playing. You've got the shooters, which I'm a big fan of, the shooters on the Mega Drive. Some of the Japanese Toplan shoot 'em ups that you can get, like Fire Shark and what's the other one? Grindstormer, VV, and all that kind of cool stuff. Eliminate Down, and all that excellent Japanese shooters that you can get.
That's one game I do not have a copy of.
I will tell you, I've got a bootleg of that game, which I feel a little dirty saying that on this podcast, but you obviously know the price of one of those cartridges. They're absolutely insane.
That's a four-digit game right there. Yeah, the most expensive shooter I have is probably Glaylancer at this point.
Yep.
But I don't think I'm ever going to be owning Eliminate Down anytime soon.
I don't have many regrets, in life, but I did pass up on that about 5 years ago, and it was around the $180 mark, and I was like, nah, I don't need this. I'm okay,
But yes, I know the feeling. That happened many times.
I think my most expensive would be Grindstormer VV. I have the Japanese version. That's probably, it's not Eliminate Down levels. It's probably around a $300 game, I think, at the moment. Yeah,
exactly. But it's a pricey game, but a lot of the games on the Mega Drive are, unfortunately.
No doubt. Slap Fight's another one that I've always wanted to get, but that's insane as far as cost goes. But I definitely don't recommend the bootleg thing, because you'll buy one and you think, oh, this is cool, but then, you're a collector, and I collect games too, and you'll just be disgusted by it. It feels
dirty somehow.
Yeah, you may as well just play your Mega SD or
exactly. Plus, there's the issues with a lot of the incorrect voltages you used in some of those bootleg boards, cheap AliExpress ones. I mean, they're not really good for your system, I suppose.
Definitely not.
So it's not, not the best option.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. But I'm with you on the Mega Drive, and I love the sound on those things, man. Like, I love that. I don't want to say this sounds bad, but that tinny FM sound, I live for that stuff. You know what I mean? I love that sound. Much more than the Super NES.
Yeah, it's interesting. Over time, like, I've always loved the Mega Drive sound, but over time, my impression of the Super NES sound is actually degraded, if you will, in the sense that it feels like a very early attempt at, the sample-based playback that would become more common.
Right.
And as a result, it just sounds kind of muffled, and everything's at it's like 32 kilohertz, I think, audio.
Yep.
But the actual samples are often, much lower than that.
Yeah.
Very small. And so it has a very muffled kind of weird sound to it, and they use too much reverb in a lot of games.
I was just about to say the same thing. A lot of musicians, for whatever reason, just packed in the reverb. I mean, there was some great soundtracks on the Super NES. I don't want to take anything away from some of the amazing producers and creators of the music, like, Chris Hulsbeck comes to mind, and some of the Japanese guys that did some amazing soundtracks, but Chrono Trigger is also another one that I'm a big fan of. But I think the hardware itself was a little different, than what I would prefer to see. I still appreciate the Super NES for sure. But I'm with you. I like the Mega Drive way better.
Yeah, that's when I had Chris Hulsbeck by here recently when we did that video together. I was very pleased that he preferred the Mega Drive sound chip.
Yeah,
to the Super NES now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The Mega Turrican soundtrack for me is superior to the Super NES, Turrican.
Oh, for sure.
Which absolutely, again, is great for all intents and purposes. It sounds fantastic, but I'm a little bit biased because I'm an Amiga guy and I prefer the original kind of TFMX soundtracks that he did on the Amiga versions. But
those are great too.
Yeah, for sure. But Mega Drive, I'm a massive fan of that system, and I know that you are as well. Is there any, what are your standout games that you really kind of go to when you want to just pick up and play for 30 minutes or so?
Well, I mean, obviously I do always love revisiting the Sonic games, but then Treasure stuff always sticks out. Dynamite Heady is one of my favorites. Rocket Knight Adventure, of course, from Konami, is a big one. Yep. A lot of the shooters, like, I really love playing Glaylancer, just because it's a great shooter, but that intro level is just incredible. Yeah. It really, really stands out. Let's see. Let me think what else here. I love Restar or Rystar, however you want to say it. Mm-hmm. One of those very late Sega games. So that's a good one as well. Castlevania Bloodlines and Contra Hardcore.
Of course.
Also great for pickup and play. And of course, the Streets of Rage games.
Yes.
Love all of them. And even, of course, the Shinobi games as well. I can't forget that.
There's just so many, isn't there? You know,
I could just go on and on.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. And like, for me, I wasn't big on Vector Man when it first came out, but I've been really appreciating both of those games a lot more these days. I love those games.
It's funny how that happens. There's a bunch of there's games like that where you look back and you never thought that much of them at the time, and then you start to put in more time now and it's like, oh wait, this is actually, there's more to this than I thought.
Yeah. So how did you end up meeting Rich, and how did you end up working for Digital Foundry? I'm really fascinated about kind of the backstory there.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting one, I suppose. So, I mean, as you can tell, I'm from the U.S. originally, mm-hmm. you know, at least based on the accent.
which part of the U.S.?
Is actually from, I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, right on. Awesome.
Which turns out to be kind of a central point for a lot of the retro gaming community these days, weirdly enough.
I was
going to
say that, yeah, My Life in Gaming.
Like a hotspot.
Yeah, there's a few of those guys live out that way.
Yeah, that's cool. Kevdris is not too far from there either. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool stuff. But essentially, my wife is from France and works for a large company and basically wanted to go back to Europe. So in 2013, I left my job, which I had worked in the auto industry for my entire career, which was by that point, I mean, I guess 8 years outside of college, and then I did some co-oping, but I did IT work, so I did a mix of things. I mean, I did programming, of course. I did a lot of database stuff. I did a lot of stuff on the back end. I worked on an IBM AS400 mainframe because, you know, companies still love those old things.
Oh, my condolences, man.
Oh, man. The green screen, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I did a lot of different things in there and traveled around some, and I just did that for a long time. I changed companies only once during that. I was with one for a while, and then I switched. And then when it was time to move to Europe, I was like, well, guess I'm quitting this. And it was just around the time when Richard put out like sort of a post on Eurogamer looking for additional help. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, I can't just go to Europe and start working right away. Like, there's a whole process to go through. I mean, you know, I'm able to stay there, but the whole visa process, the work permit stuff, all of that stuff, it's not quick or easy. So I thought, well, let's just try this for now. So I got in touch, and he kind of responded and said, basically sent me like a test, so to speak, which was really no more than just like basically do one of the analysis, but like not for publishing, just like do your own take on it.
Right.
And I got to do Crysis 3. Which turned out to be a good choice because there's a lot to talk about with Crysis 3.
So. Yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm assuming you covered both the PC and the console ports, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Looking at all the different versions and checking that out. And then, you know, that kind of worked out. And I kind of just started as a freelancer for a while. So I wasn't doing that much work. And we were just article-based back then when I started, but then I guess eventually I kind of got on full time, and now I'm like salaried and everything, so that's great. And I guess it was in 2015 when we did it almost sounds comical to say the pivot to video, but that's, you know, what it was. It was like, okay, we need to start doing YouTube stuff,
right?
And so I had been doing some videos on the side on my own personal channels, I guess, that were just kind of like testing those waters. I was like, well, I can do videos like this. He's like, all right, give it a try. And so I kind of went from there and just been refining that since 2015.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, obviously Digital Foundry on YouTube is been very, very successful for you guys. I'm actually fascinated that YouTube was not the kind of main medium of your work up until like 3 years ago, you said. So was it basically just, Eurogamer articles and things like that?
Yeah, exactly. So it was literally just Eurogamer articles. We had screenshot galleries, and then the video side was just raw analysis from our frame rate tool, which we would then upload to our internal video player.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it was all, you know, very done on, you know, with our own CMS and everything, you know, no external services really. But obviously the big thing there is that when you're just posting videos of just footage of the frame rate or something, it's not really compelling to watch. Like, you would click through it and see some results and then you're done. Like, it was just a supplemental thing to the article.
Right.
You weren't really telling a story with it. It was just, you know, that. So
yeah,
obviously that wasn't going to work.
Yeah. Well, the YouTube thing obviously has been working out for you guys. The success you've had on the channel has been great. I'm a huge fan of the DF Retro stuff that you do, and I want to talk about that in some detail. But how did you convince the guys at Digital Foundry that, hey, I want to do some kind of retro style stuff? Is this something that Rich basically says, hey, you know, you go off and do your own stuff, and we'll back you 100%? Or was there a bit of a convincing process that needed to occur before you could put DF Retro stuff on the channel? What did that look like?
That's interesting. So the way it went down, initially what happened is, I guess in the spring, we had heard rumors about a possible Shenmue 3 announcement thing at E3.
Yeah.
That it was, and Richard was like, oh, we should do like a retrospective on Shenmue, you know, just in preparation for that. And I was like, I do love Shenmue. So I just kind of sat down and I did that first video, but it wasn't exactly as it was published. I did a video on Shenmue kind of like that, and then I showed it, and then we just like sat on it. I never actually fully finished it. It just kind of sat on my hard drive for a while. It's like, okay, forgot about it. And then I guess E3 came and went, and there was no new news on Shenmue 3, so it didn't even make sense there. But what ended up happening instead was, after E3 that year, I had returned and I came back with a copy of Quake for the Sega Saturn,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, I love what Lobotomy Software does. And that was the one game of theirs I didn't have at the time. So I picked that up and I was playing through it and just kind of amazed at what they achieved on there using their own engine, translating that game over. And so on a whim, like on a Saturday, I was just like, started capturing it. I thought I should just throw together a quick little video. And by quick, I mean it's like 6 minutes long.
Right.
Which at the time, we weren't doing that many long videos, but I just did this little video on a whim, like on a random weekend afternoon. And then I finished it and I just sent it to Richard and I said, can we just post this? And he looked at it and he's like, yeah, okay, that's fine. So I just kind of came up, I just like slapped the retro thing onto the end of that and put it online, and people liked it. I was like, okay, maybe I should do more of this stuff. Even though Richard picked a hilarious thumbnail for that video, it's like one of the Quake enemies, but with like an eyebrows drawn on him. It's very silly. I'm not really sure how he stumbled on that image.
I got to go back and look at that thumbnail. I don't recall that, but I recall the video, and I remember when it dropped, I was like, dude, this is like one of the best videos I've ever seen. I was really in awe of it, man. I really enjoyed it, and I remember when it came out, I think you were on Twitter maybe, you know, a few hours later saying, hey, if you guys want to see some other cool retro stuff, let me know what you're looking for. And you know, that kind of started the DF Retro thing, where, you know, I don't want to say like every Sunday, but like most Sundays for a while you were dropping like DF Retro videos. And man, my favorite one is, out of all of them, and I did like the Quake one a lot, but my favorite one is the Silent Hill 2 video that you put together. I'll be honest with you, man, like I sometimes watch your videos to inspire my creation process, because sometimes, like, and you probably can relate to this, but sometimes I'm trying to slap together a video and I'm just, it's not working for me, it's not feeling good. I'll do B-roll, and you know, there's some focus issues, or it's not balanced properly, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then I'll just step away and just watch someone else's content. And I usually break out a DF Retro and say, okay, I've got some really cool ideas now, I want to get back to this. And it really does help me. But I love the Silent Hill 2 video, man. That was a masterpiece of a video, in my opinion. I really enjoyed that one. I love the research that you put into it, as well as the comparisons you made with the other versions of Silent Hill 2, which I thought the Xbox original version was okay, but I didn't realize how how different it was really compared to the PlayStation 2 version. And your video really illustrated that. So yeah, I loved it, man.
I love doing all that kind of stuff. And yeah, the thing I guess that inspires me to do those videos is when I, you know, I just like to fiddle around with these games in the back, you know, try to, especially if you can like, okay, can I like actually like open assets from this game and mess around with this in some kind of other software package and, or peek under the hood or, you know, jump into, like, I always love the features in Dolphin, the emulator, how you can decouple the camera from where the game is intended to be drawing from.
Yeah.
And like, just kind of see it break apart and you start to figure out like the way that they've set everything up. And that stuff is really interesting to me. So I just like to explore that. And that's usually what triggers it.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem for me though, is like those episodes can take a lot of time to make.
Yeah, you
and
can.
Our schedule's pretty brutal, right?
Yeah,
it's like we pretty much have to do 2 videos a week, each of us, most of the time. And, you know, those retro videos take a lot of time. So it ends up usually being like a lot of crunching and working all weekend. And it's because I care. It's not like I'm being forced to do it. It's like, okay, well, I really want to do this well. So I'm there doing it as best as I can. But as I've done more, I keep getting more ambitious with what I want to do. And then I end up putting it off because like, oh man, it's going to take so much work to actually do it.
Yeah.
And as a result, I'm just making less of those, especially when combined with all the other stuff happening. So I really want to try to find like this balance of doing a mix of the more like lavish episodes, but then get back to that first year when I was doing more episodes on a regular basis, but they maybe weren't always like super, super long or like huge epics or anything, you know?
I'm with you, man. I mean, everything you said, I was just nodding my head because I understand it's a very similar process with me in that YouTube is not my full-time job. So I do it on the side. So I release videos every single week and I usually, and you mentioned, you know, you get more ambitious and you have to spend a lot of time. I mean, watching one of your DF Retro videos, I have a pretty good idea about how much time you're putting into making those things based on my experiences. So, yeah. You know, I work 40 hours a week full time and then I kind of try to crunch a video out every single week. So I'm like you, I'm working on weekends and working nights and all that stuff. And it's not a job. It's because I love it. You know, I'm really passionate about the content that I make and it really shows with the DF Retro stuff. So I get it. And trying to find that happy balance can be tricky. And, you know, I don't have any answers there for you, unfortunately. I think, like you said, you know, maybe you just have to be less aggressive as far as when you think you're going to get those videos released into the wild, yeah. I guess. You know what I mean?
And it's also like I've thought about just scaling back the topics again, like instead of like going insane with how much covered, like for December, I kind of wanted to cover a couple Star Wars games, mm-hmm. go back to like Shadows of the Empire. I just got a physical PC copy. For my old PC here.
And I was nice.
I should talk about this game, compare it to the N64, and also talk about all the stuff that happened around it, like the figures and the comic books and all that.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's a fairly focused thing. And then maybe also cover, like, in a second video, do like Jedi Knight, Dark Forces, those games.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I love those titles as well. And, you know, that's a fairly narrow scope, simple topic, and maybe it's interesting to people. So.
Yeah.
Could be fun to make and not too stressful.
Are there any other DF Retro videos in the works that you want to reveal to the audience?
I do have a couple. So I have a couple that have been in the works for a while that I haven't really started. And one that is, I want to do, but that's okay. So I filmed something a while ago at a very well-known British developer.
Mm-hmm.
With a bunch of the developers that were still there during that era. I filmed it like last year even. And it's a lot of amazing information going back to like the mid early 90s all the way up till today. Tons of games that they worked on. Some very, very, very popular games.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say who it was yet, but it should be really interesting. And it's proving to be one of the biggest projects yet, just in terms of when you have like 8 hours of filmed interview footage, like sifting through that and figuring out how am I going to tell a story and also cover like the billion games that they've made.
Yeah.
That's really difficult. So I've really kind of struggled with that one, but
yeah,
working on it. But I still want to do more. I really want to do more systems episodes like I did for the 32X.
I love, dude, that was kind of probably my second favorite. I loved both of those videos that you did on the 32X.
It's fun, right? Just like going through most of, or an entire library in that case, and just really trying to see what was done on it.
Yeah.
And especially on systems that are less popular. Like I have had in the works, and I have partially done an episode on the Jaguar. Want to do one on like the 3DO, you know, systems like this that aren't talked about, but I really want to look at them with a critical eye and consider what was done that was impressive.
Yeah.
You know, because there is some cool stuff on these systems. They, you know, they're failures, I guess, at the market, but there was a lot of creativity and interesting things happening there that I think a lot of people, that's one of the things I try to do, is present things in a more interesting, like positive way, so to speak, like look for the good in things rather than being like the angry gamer stereotype where you're just like, oh, well, this is terrible.
Right.
It's like, I want to find the good stuff. Like, what makes this actually interesting or good? If there is anything, you know.
Yeah. I think the 3DO would be something that I'd love to see you work on. I have a system, and I've done a little bit of kind of back research on the 3DO, but I think you could, that would be a lot of really interesting material, because so many different game developers worked on the 3DO in some capacity, and there were some really good games that came out for it, especially, you know, the Street Fighter game and the Samurai Showdown game, and as well as some of the early 3D games that came out for it as well. And then obviously you've got things like Doom, which was obviously not very well developed, given the constraints that you know, Becky Heinemann had at the time, all things considered, it actually wasn't really that bad. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stories and a lot of interesting topics to talk about on that system.
Yeah, and the 3DO is interesting because it came out at the tail end, or kind of in the middle of the 16-bit generation, right? And everybody was used to 2D platformers and 2D action games, and the Mega Drive and Super NES were very well suited to that. I mean, they had hardware that could handle tile maps and sprites and all that. That's what they were designed to do. The 3DO doesn't have any of that.
Yeah.
You're basically just drawing to a frame buffer slowly. So every time you change a pixel on a full screen of pixels, it's a more expensive operation.
Mm-hmm.
So actually just doing a scrolling play field in 2D is really difficult, which is why there's maybe two or three games in the entire system that run at 60 frames per second.
Yeah. Yeah.
Street Fighter is one of them.
Yep.
But even stuff like Samurai Showdown, it's like 20 to 30 frames per second.
Yeah. There's dips there. Yeah.
Same with Gex, you know, mm-hmm. It's a 2D side scroller, but it runs at a very low frame rate.
It does. Yeah. I thought Gex was like running at like 25, and they were going for that like movie, you know, that television style, you know, cartoon style. I thought maybe they did that intentionally, but you're right. I think in the end, it was really a limitation of the hardware and what they had to work with.
Yeah, I mean, the 3DO could do some neat 3D stuff, but it just wasn't made for 2D.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's still better than the CDI, though, which has it has no hardware assistance for any sort of drawing routines. It's literally just, well, you can pipe video through this thing, and that's about it. Like, everything that was ever achieved on CDI had to be done entirely in software, pretty much driven by the 68070, I think, it had in there.
Mm-hmm.
Some variant of the 68000. Good CPU. They just didn't have the graphics to back it up.
Yeah, that's true. What is your favorite DF Retro episode that you're most proud of?
I mean, I always love the Doom one. That was good fun.
That was a good video.
I even though it's not perfect, I was a big fan of what I did with the Donkey Kong Country one with all the original guys that are now at Playtonic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just that was a really fun project to look at. And yeah, that was one of my first filmed projects as well. So it was very satisfying to make.
Yeah, like I said, man, I love that series. And hopefully, you know, obviously you're very, very busy with, you know, the mainstream work that you guys do there at Digital Foundry. But I do hope that you continue to do the DF Retro stuff. It's I know myself and many others that both of us know. We all really appreciate the work that you put into it, for sure. And I, like I said, I really understand the amount of time that you have to put into those things. Even just capturing footage, you know, is takes many, many hours. I mean, you want to get to a certain point in the game. Sure, you can maybe sometimes grab a save file, but sometimes you can't, and you have to just kind of grind your way through the game in order to get there, or use some kind of cheat code.
Exactly. If you want to show the game in its entirety and really show the interesting stuff, you got to play through it and capture it.
Yeah, it's easy. I guess it's easier for the cartridge-based stuff, but for the disc-based stuff, it gets a little trickier, you know, in order to find the right save file or a trainer or a cheat code or something. But with Digital Foundry, obviously that you know takes up pretty much all of your time these days. What do you do for fun outside of work when you're not playing video games? What do you do like for hobbies and fun outside of all this video game stuff?
Oh, well, I spend a lot of time with my son. Love playing with him. Good times there, even though sometimes it also involves video games. I love cycling, so I like to do that. Hanging out with friends, of course, is great. You know, that kind of stuff. I enjoy some films and all that. You know, spending time with the wife.
Yeah.
You know, just doing more relaxed things. And, you know, when I can, it's fun traveling around as well. You know, socializing with people, getting out and enjoying the outdoors. You know, usually when I finish a big project, I love to just take the bike out and go ride off somewhere for, you know, a few hours.
Very cool.
Just like get over it, so to speak, because you can't kind of strap to your desk for a while during this.
Definitely. Yeah, no, I get it, man. Like, I think having a, you know, the ability to unplug is very important with what you do. And it really makes a lot of sense. I know for myself, I'm very much the same. I usually have a few days off where I just don't even think about content creation, video games, and just unwind, you know. But
you need it.
Yeah, you absolutely need it for sure. Now, with video games today in 2019, what do you think about the landscape of video games? I've had this discussion with some other people, and some people think that the best era of video games was, you know, the 16-bit era, the Mega Drive and the Super NES that we talked about. Some people think that it's the kind of 6th-gen Xbox original PlayStation 2 GameCube, which I personally am a big fan of that era, probably more than most. But a lot of people think that this modern era, you know, microtransactions and loot boxes aside, video games are as good as they've ever been. What do you think is the best era in gaming? You know, what's your opinion on that?
Oh, man. Best versus favorite. I mean, for me, like, my favorite is probably sometime, like, I can't pinpoint it exactly, but I'd say, like, the mid to late 90s range, both in terms of what was happening on the consoles, but also what was happening in the PC space. They were kind of doing their own thing.
Yeah.
Every platform was offering its own unique selection of games, and a lot of those games would go on to define, like, future generations. It was such an interesting, important, experimental time. Everybody was just throwing things at the wall, and you ended up with some just crazy creativity. The arcades were still thriving. You're still getting like cutting-edge arcade games from Sega and the like. So like everything seemed to be going very well during that period.
Yeah.
So that might be my favorite period, I'd say. Oh, but as for what's the best, I mean, oof, that's so hard to say. I mean, I do think games right now are in a pretty good spot overall, but you know, in terms of what's actually coming out, there's a lot of interesting stuff, both from big publishers, but a lot of the smaller games as well, I think, are just phenomenal these days. Like what these small indie teams are doing, they've really like refined the art of creating, like, both, you know, obviously new creative interesting ideas, but also going back to classics and sort of reviving them in interesting ways. And like a lot of these guys, they really get it. They understand what makes these games so great, and they're doing an amazing job like bringing it back. But you know, that's just like a tiny little piece of what's going on as a whole. There's just so much. And even things I'm not into phone games, for instance, but that's, you know, that's good for some people. There's, there's the VR side of things. There's esports. It feels like, you know, there's something for everyone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's no matter what you're into, you're going to find something that you really like or can really enjoy. So I feel like we've never had so much variety before. So in that sense, you know, I think we're in a great spot. The only issue I see right now is that game budgets are just kind of insane.
Yes.
And I don't know how long that can last. So like, it seems like it's at a, for the larger productions, like it does seem like it's in a slightly precarious position, if you will.
Definitely. Yeah, it does. It is an interesting point. And you're probably more privy to, you know, budgets that were spent on games than me, but I get that sense as well that, you know, there's these huge budget games that are being developed and many of them just don't end up selling as much as they thought at all. And, you know, one that comes to mind is obviously Anthem, which was just a failure in all areas. And, you know, the amount of money investment that gets spent on these games and for them to miss the mark so much really just shows you that, hey, maybe we do need to step back and go back to, I don't want to say basics, but, you know, step back a little bit and cut the budgets down and really just start thinking about good games first before, you know, we start tacking on, you know, microtransactions and make everything service-based. And I think EA, with the release of Need for Speed Heat and more recently Star Wars, which is a single-player experience with no loot boxes, and hopefully that will stay that way, hopefully, you know, they've gone past that point where they're like, well, hey, maybe we shouldn't be investing so much time and money in these things, and maybe we should be coming up with good games that people want to play and people want to buy and enjoy for, you know, 10, 12, 15 hours rather than trying to, you know, dangle that carrot of a service-based approach that hey, may or may not be successful for us.
Yeah, that's a tricky thing. The thing I worry about there is I don't feel like Need for Speed Heat and Star Wars received all that much marketing support somehow.
They didn't at all, really.
They were games that just kind of silently released one day and they're just out there. And I don't think the brand is necessarily strong enough to carry it on its own, which sounds weird to say about Star Wars, but you just didn't hear that much about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you know, I feel like Fallen Order could have been just exceptionally well received if it was not for... It just feels unfinished. Like, it feels like it's maybe 3 months ahead of schedule,
mm-hmm.
where there's a lot of bugs and issues in it that sort of detract from the overall experience. Like, they were so close to delivering something that was just about perfect, but it's not quite there.
Yeah.
And I think it's fixable, but you only get one first impression. And I hope that this doesn't sour anyone on creating that type of game, at least within EA. Like, I love the fact that it is just a full-on single-player experience like that with nothing, no connection to it. You don't have to log into your EA account. There's no microtransactions. You just start the game and go, and that's refreshing.
For sure. What do you think? Do you think the timing of the Star Wars game was bad? Because, you know, it came out the same day as Pokemon, which is not... Obviously, there's a different demographic there of people that are going to buy Pokemon versus Star Wars, but there's going to be some overlap there for sure. Like myself, I picked up both games on that day. But it also came out, you know, a week after, like, Death Stranding came out. But do you think it was kind of tied into those games, or do you think it was just released ahead of the next Star Wars movie that's coming out, obviously, in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I've thought about that as well. Like, it does seem like it came out at maybe like a weird dead period, but also still too close to big games in a way. Like,
yeah.
It's the kind of thing where now it really is a dead period going forward. And I feel like if they had just waited another week or two, it may have made more of an impact. It's really hard to say, though, because there just wasn't that much visible marketing there,
mm-hmm.
from their side. So it was really hard to get the word out about this thing.
Yeah, that's true. I think the game is pretty good. I mean, I played it on the PC, so I picked it up the day it came out on Origin. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely issues with the game, and I was noticing them myself, that it was probably just needs some more polish in order to, like you said, it was three quarters complete. I do agree with that. I think they should have spent a little bit more time fixing the game up, and, you know, maybe even releasing it like a week before the movie had come out, you know, giving it a couple more weeks in the oven to really, you know, polish the game up. But hey, it's still a pretty good game. I'm pretty happy with the result.
Yeah, I agree.
Especially given EA's track record, you know, over the last, you know, 13 months, or sorry, the last 18 months or so with their releases. So
Hey, well, it is Respawn, so
they
have a pretty good track record.
That's true. But you know, Respawn's always had, obviously Apex Legends was massively successful. I'm not taking that away from them, but Titanfall 1 and 2 didn't sell as well as they thought those games would sell for them. But obviously Apex Legends has sold extremely well for them and is doing very well for them. But Respawn's always been that shop where they bring out some amazing games, you know, both technically and from a gameplay perspective. They're excellent games, excellent quality games. Vince Zampella is, you know, he's obviously been around video games for many years and he knows how to make good games, but for whatever reason they just don't sell as well as they should have sold. And I think back to Titanfall 2, and that had a similar thing with Destiny, I believe, that it was kind of up there with some other big titles and that kind of got lost in the mix as well. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think they released it right around the same time as Battlefield 1.
That's right.
It was pouring a lot of money into supporting, and then also there was the Call of Duty thing.
Yes, that's correct. There.
And I actually, so I've kind of thought about this, but I kind of get the feeling that the Titanfall name was almost slightly poisoned by being associated with Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Xbox One first launched, obviously the backlash against it was massive. People were not fans of that thing, and they were very vocal about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of that was deserved, but I think if you were connected to it at the time and Titanfall was being marched around as the big exclusivity, it kind of sits in your brain, or a lot of people is like, oh, that's that Xbox game. And somehow I have to wonder if that has like a negative connotation. Like when it did end up launching as Titanfall 2, then, you know, were the PlayStation people as interested? Did that somehow, like, if it had been a PS4 exclusive during the launch period when PS4 was really taking off, what would that have done for that franchise, I wonder?
Right.
Like, then it may have been cemented in PlayStation gamers' minds as this big thing, and then suddenly Titanfall 2 comes out and it's big. Or I really can't say. It's all just, you know, thinking out loud, I suppose. But it does seem like when it did finally get that sequel, like, somehow people just didn't pay attention.
Yeah.
And also, I guess it's weird to go from an entirely multiplayer-driven game to a game that has one of the best single-player shooter campaigns of the generation. Like, you wouldn't have expected that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially coming from, I mean, they have that Call of Duty legacy, and they make very polished campaigns, but they're always so scripted and just not that interesting to me, I feel. Like, it's all on the cinematics, but everything you're attacking is just little guys at a distance while you hide behind cover. But Titanfall was a very different kind of experience,
I think, in
the single player, and it was more Half-Life than it was Call of Duty in a lot of ways.
But
you know, getting the word out of what that was probably wasn't easy, and I'm sure a lot of people just passed it over without even giving it a second thought.
I agree with you. I thought the game was great, and you're right, I got that Half-Life 2 vibe from playing the campaign. But yeah, it was really one of those games, like you said, that just did get passed over, timing and yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think the Xbox One exclusivity probably hurt that game more than it helped it in the end, unfortunately. But hopefully we'll see Titanfall, you know, make a resurgence at some point. I mean, you know, they did come out and say that, hey, it's not dead, you know, it's still alive, guys. So, you know, maybe we'll hear something about that, you know, in the coming year or so, maybe with next gen. Maybe they may bring it back. That'd be really cool to see. We met briefly at E3 this year, and I remember we were at the Poly Mega booth, and I know that you were busy, you know, doing your E3 stuff. You had a lot of things going on. E3 was
running around. Yeah, it was just like, oh, what do I do next?
It was crazy this year, man. But I wanted to ask your thoughts about the Poly Mega. I guess two questions: emulation and the Poly Mega system. Give me your take on both of those things.
I mean, I love emulation. I love what it offers. I mean, I don't use it that much personally, but that's just because, you know, some weird nostalgic, like, I just appreciate playing on original hardware. But it's so important for preservation and the future of all this stuff. And the emulator authors out there, like, a lot of these guys, they're just doing remarkable work, and just the quality is really the quality and the breadth of support, the number of platforms that are supported, like, it's really great, and I'm very happy that this exists. So I'm a big proponent of that. And also, I guess I was very impressed with the Poly Mega at E3.
Yeah.
I was a little bit, it seems like it's gone somewhat silent lately. perhaps they're having manufacturing issues, which that actually makes plenty of sense, I suppose, because that's not an, you know, manufacturing is difficult.
Yes.
A lot can go wrong, especially with a product that's relatively complex in terms of the way it has all those modules and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a simple idea, but I was extremely impressed by what it offered as an emulation box at E3. It was a very polished experience at that point. Nice looking hardware. The games just mostly worked very well. I mean, I could see issues with Saturn emulation, but they were relatively minor and only in a few instances.
Yeah.
Everything else seemed really good. I mean, it's very promising. I want to know more about what's under the hood there and really get my hands on it and test it to say for sure. But it's a very promising solution. And I kind of see it. I could see that as something I would leave hooked up to like the living room TV, where I don't have all my game stuff connected all the time.
Yeah.
Many reasons, but just having like a neat, clean box that you could just pop in something into and play it down there. That's a fun idea. And I think it could fit in there. It's a way to have multiple systems in an easy to use box. That's not like a home theater PC kind of setup, which, you know, those can be great, but also still a little bit fiddly in terms of the UI stuff, I think.
Yes. So
just having this as like a standalone unit, it's a cool idea. So I hope it works out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't want to say that I was a hater of the Polymega when they announced it. I was skeptical of it. Let's put it that way. I was, you know, we've heard this before, you know, with these cheap ARM-based, you know, devices that run emulation, you know, that they're trying to slap on a CD drive and make it kind of play everything, but the experience isn't very good. Obviously, this is not that. This is a, you know, an AMD-based or an Intel-based x86 or x64-based system that runs its own kind of custom Linux variation that has this, you know, pretty decent user experience from a UI perspective, as well as some really good, I won't say perfect emulation, but very good emulation, all things considered. And yeah, the overall experience, I was impressed too. I kind of walked away feeling, yeah, this is no joke. I mean, this is something that they're really putting, you know, a lot of love and a lot of care into to make this a really good system that everyone will enjoy, especially, you know, fans of retro and fans of emulation as well. So yeah, I'm with you, man. Like, I actually pre-ordered it, and I'm kind of wondering where it is too, because I heard by the end of the summer that, you know, we would have an update, and you know, hopefully they'll start sending units out. But I'm with you, man. Like, I want to put mine in my living room and have it as kind of the all-in-one setup where I can play pretty much everything retro on it. So I'm looking forward to it as well. But hopefully, you know, they'll announce something here before the end of the year. I doubt we'll see it before the end of this year. I mean, no, obviously,
probably not.
Yeah, I mean, Christmas is fast approaching, but hopefully sometime early next year we'll get our hands on the system.
I'll just say, I guess I feel compelled to make a video on it.
Yeah.
I only like to make videos on hardware when it's actually like some kind of hardware that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, it's not like I'm just like reviewing tons of hardware. It's like, if I see something that actually interests me, it's like, okay, well,
yeah,
I would like to cover this. And usually, thankfully, my interests are, you know, the products end up being pretty good where I'm like, okay, I'm interested in this. And oh, it is actually pretty good. I think the only exception to that was that PlayStation Classic thing, which was just...
That was a disaster, wasn't it?
It was a train wreck, yeah.
And I, you know, you can buy those for $20 pretty much everywhere now. And I paid full price on day one, you know. Oof. I got a day one edition, and I felt the pain of that one. It was not a good experience, unfortunately. But yeah, I'm with you, man. Like I do. And I'm planning on reviewing it too, and I'll pull it apart, but I definitely want to see your take on the emulation. I think the biggest takeaway for me was you obviously have a better eye than me when it comes to some of these things. I thought the Saturn emulation overall was pretty good, but my biggest issue that I had was, and I mentioned this to the guy, Brian, who owns Polymega, was there was something not right with the Genesis emulation. The sound emulation was just a little bit off for me. There was something not quite right. And I know that emulating the sound on a Genesis it takes a monumental effort to get it right. So hopefully, you know, they took that away and they're working on that piece.
Yeah, that's the thing about that is that all that analog circuitry adds character to it. And it's something that varies significantly per unit.
Yeah.
As well. So like actually perfectly emulating the sound chip can produce results that don't sound correct. You know what I mean? Because it's influenced by other factors in the real hardware. And I think that's why Kevtris added in all that stuff, you know, and analog patched in the firmware to include all those adjustments you could make on the Mega SG.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the only way to really get it right is to be able to fine tune everything yourself.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure there is like a one size fits all solution for Mega Drive sound emulation, to be honest. So we'll have to see how that goes. That's actually one of the things I expressed wanting to see in the Polymega was like an advanced mode where you could sort of like really tweak the emulation functions and like the video and audio output and everything to your liking, while then just having a regular default mode. It's simple for most people that don't want to fiddle with that stuff.
For sure. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think adding those types of filters and those advanced settings would be very, very helpful. Hopefully we'll see something like that. But yeah, and again, you know, hopefully we'll see the product come out sooner rather than later, because I'm excited to get my hands on it. I wasn't a big fan of it, but as I've played it firsthand, just like you, I kind of walked away feeling pretty good about it.
Yeah, for sure.
You're a big fan of CRTs. Tell me about your CRT collection. I'm fascinated. I've got a couple myself. I've got a 15-inch PVM, which is kind of my main monitor for retro games, you know, the 15 kilohertz stuff. But I also have a couple of VGA monitors on my PC. But you've got like the Mac Daddy, the Sony monitor there. So tell me about your awesome CRT collection that you got going on.
Well, let's see here. Here in Germany, I have 4 or 5 CRTs, I think, lying around. Then I have more that I left back in the States. So I've kind of hoarded some of them over the years.
They're hard to they're hard to give away, aren't they? Well, they're hard to get rid of.
Exactly. So my main one I use is a 20-inch 20L4, a pretty late generation model.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get a 20L5 because obviously that supports higher resolution. It's the exact same tube, but it allows like 480p, 720p, but that doesn't seem to have been sold in Europe. I've never seen it for sale.
Mm-hmm.
So the only other solution is like a certain variant, BVM variant.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately is also rather difficult to obtain, but maybe someday I'll find one. But that's my main monitor for retro consoles. And then for PC, the main monitor I use is the Sony FW900.
Tell me how you end up getting one of those things. I want to know the story, because there are people that I know of that have been looking for one of those for almost 2 years, you know, and come up with nothing.
It's one of those things where it's a very lucky thing where I guess a follower on Twitter who lives in Germany was very kind enough to reach out and say that, hey, I have one of these things. I haven't really been able to use it that much. I'm away during my studies. Are you interested in it, basically? So I was like, yeah, absolutely. And he quoted me a very reasonable price, let's just say.
Excellent.
Far more than you might expect.
Excellent.
Which, you know, I was extremely generous of him to do that. And I drove like 2-something hours to go pick it up. We hung out for the day and chatted for a while and had a very pleasant time. And I came back with this insane monitor, which, you know, 43 kilos, it's not a light thing.
No.
But yeah, so, you know, when I first got it, you know, the settings were kind of somewhat not to my taste. Like they had like the G2 voltage cranked up real high, so it was brighter, but it washed out all the blacks, and there were some color accuracy issues. So I actually did put together, I guess, like a using like a little Arduino thing, like set up the cable connection so that I could plug into the pins on the service port on the monitor,
right?
And then bring that out to USB, plug it into a computer. And then I guess he goes by Space Diver on one of these forums here. He reached out to us and gave us this insane amounts of information on calibrating these things. So I've been chatting with him, and he's like, okay, try it. Like, he recommended a nice calibration tool one of those, like, it's like the eye display something or other. So I picked one of those up and I went through the whole like hour long calibration process recently. Was able to, that's one of the things I love about it is you get in there with this calibration software and you have like extreme control over the monitor to the point where, you know, you could technically kind of break it if you didn't know what you're doing.
Right. Because
you're directly adjusting like voltages and like low level stuff on the monitor.
Yeah.
So if you're not very cautious and understand what you're doing, it's, you know, it's meant for like servicing.
Yeah.
But it gives you enough control where you can sort of perfect the monitor. So I managed to get settings dialed in on this thing where it just looks absolutely unbelievable. It's so accurate, clean, and just, man, it looks so rich and nice in a way that's hard to explain. I mean, it's not as bright as an LCD. That's just not how it's going to go. But the way it handles, and this is what I love about CRTs, the way they handle low luminance combined with the excellent motion handling. I always use the old Thief games as a great example. I used to play that back in the day on the CRT. When you're sneaking around in the dark,
yeah,
it really felt like you were in the dark, right?
I know what you're saying. Yeah,
I'm like with you. The output of the monitor when displaying those dark shades was suitably low. Like it could get very, very dark. And it's not just about displaying absolute black. It's about those really subtle shades of gray down to the super low levels of light. So you could really get this feeling of creeping around in the dark. You load that up on an LCD and it's 100% gone.
Yeah.
Like you see the backlight, and even on something like an OLED where it has these perfect blacks, unless you hugely turn down the OLED light or something, you know, the actual output of the display when showing colors is still very, very bright.
Mm-hmm.
So you have absolute black, but then next to it, you have very bright colors. So it never really has that same feeling of being in a dark area. There's just this natural look to these analog picture tubes that somehow really, really, like, it brings a mood and a feeling to these games in a way that you just don't get with these flat panels.
And yeah.
Then, you know, motion is perfect. And you can do super high refresh rates, like 160 hertz or something on here. There's no blurring or sort of, you don't get any of that blurring or trailing that you get on LCDs. And LCDs can get closer with sort of like, I guess, flickering, like kind of like black frame insertion, you know, the ultra low motion blur. But that dims the picture more so than the CRT, and it still doesn't quite look the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's just, plus, you know, since I use a lot of retro PC stuff on here with an old P3, CRTs handle low resolutions well.
Yep.
You can throw up, you know, 640 by 480 on there and it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Whereas you scale it up on an LCD and it's kind of a blurry mess usually.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like everything you said is resonating with me, especially with you mentioned Thief. I mean, another game for me that I noticed that when like Splinter Cell, you know, when I played Splinter Cell on like the original Xbox on a CRT, and then you would play Splinter Cell on the 360 on an LCD, there was just, you know, the dark areas were just, they were lost in translation, you know, with the change of the display that you had. And unfortunately, LCDs, no matter, like you said, or OLEDs, even plasma. I mean, I have an old plasma TV downstairs in my living room, which I love my plasma TV because they have some really rich colors, but it's just not the same, man. You know, it's just not the same as a tube. And unfortunately, you know, they're trying to get picture quality better, you know, with this technology, and maybe one day they'll nail it, right? But you can't beat the old tubes, you know, you can't beat the old CRTs. So I'm very, very jealous of that CRT that you have. I'm very envious of one. I would love to get my hands on one of those babies for sure.
Oh yeah, they are. The only complaint I have with the 900 compared to, I also have a Sony G400 PC monitor, which is smaller. And it's a lower quality tube overall, but that one has sort of a very dark black tint on the glass.
Right.
Whereas the FW900, like a lot of reference monitors I've seen, like the tube itself has a somewhat gray appearance, which means, and it just sort of like, I guess it absorbs light. So if you play in a dark room, it looks amazing. But if you switch on all the lights or let the sun shine right into the room,
yeah,
like it just washes it out into a sea of gray. Like yeah. It's just the physical, like the tube itself is that way. And it doesn't have to be that way, as you can see with other monitors. But for whatever reason, all these high-end professional CRTs don't seem to have very good... I don't know what... Maybe it's something to do with purity, or there's black filters like reduce accuracy or something, but you just have that raw gray glass that... So you really have to play it in a dark room.
What are some of the games that really make the monitor pop, that just you sit back and think, holy shit, this is amazing?
Oh, man. I think recently playing Blood, the one that Kaiser and Night Dive released,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
at 120 hertz, but at a lower pixel resolution, which was more fitting of that game.
Yes.
And just seeing the smoothness of it and the way it handles the darkness, it really, really works so well. And then also something like Quake 2 RTX.
Oh, dude, yeah.
Messing around with the ray tracing there. It looks so natural.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that would be like a demo that I would put on, to impress someone with the monitor,
Because it really, really does, especially because with that game, because it's a path tracer, you can't just run it at 4K and get high resolutions. You have to use res scaling. But on a CRT, you can just... Like, I have it outputting at 1280 by 800. Intentionally, I kept the resolution very low,
mm-hmm.
So that I could run it at 120 hertz and hit 120 FPS constant.
Nice.
With full path tracing. Obviously, if I even go up to like 1920 by 1200, that already starts to eat into the frame rate. So it's a demanding thing. But yeah, 1280 by 800 looks amazing on a CRT, and playing that game at 120 hertz, like, it's just unbelievable to see.
Are there any other CRTs that you have your eyes on picking up, or is it more a case of if something cool comes along, I may jump on it and pick up another one?
Well, if I find one of those, 20-inch BVMs with support for 480p, 720p, and the like, I would definitely go for that, just because I'd like to add that support into the mix. I mean, the 20L4 it's one of the 800 line late generation Sony picture tubes. It looks pretty good. It's the same tube as the 20L5. It's really just the electronics that are different.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But since the L5 wasn't sold here, I guess I have to look to that one. I mean, I can't really go. I would love one of the larger ones at some point, but I just don't have the room to do, like a friend of mine here in Germany has like 3 32-inch BVMs.
Oh my God.
And these things are so deep. I mean, it's basically a table. It's a square on top. It's enormous. You just having the room for that, it's insane.
Yeah. Plus the weight. I mean,
they weigh like 300 pounds or something.
Yeah. I mean, I have an arcade cabinet downstairs, a Japanese Sega cabinet, and it has a 29-inch Toshiba CRT in there, and that thing. I want to rotate the monitor so I can play vertical shoot 'em ups, that takes two people, it's not a one man job to basically bolt it out of the chassis and then flip it around, there's a lot of weight there. So I can't imagine how much a 32 inch would weigh. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah. Especially when it's encased in that steel or whatever metal they use on a PVM case.
Yeah,
it gets industrial.
It gets to the point where you need more than just living room furniture to put these things on. You need something more, to kind of show these things off on,
Yeah, I actually had to look up the specs on my desk to ensure that I could safely put the FW900 on here along with everything else.
Yeah.
And it's just under the limit. But it was almost borderline. I was like, oh man, this thing, it's really it weighs a lot. It's really heavy.
It's hilarious when you're buying furniture around the CRT that you own versus, hey, I want to buy some furniture for aesthetic purposes. You're buying it to see if it's gonna sustain the weight of this heavy ass CRT that you just picked up. I know the feeling. we're gonna wrap it up here, but I want to say that I really appreciate the work that you do. Thank you so much for coming on and hanging out with me for the last hour or so. Your passion and love for video games, both modern and retro, is just contagious, and I'm a huge fan of you and the stuff that you guys do on Digital Foundry. So I just want to keep up the good work. Before we wrap up, for those people that may not be familiar with you, where can they find you?
Okay, well, I'm over on Twitter at Dark1X, old name there, still around. or at Eurogamer.net/Digital Foundry, and of course, YouTube.com/Digital Foundry, where we find all of our videos.
Awesome. And I'll
leave. We even have a Patreon. Oh, so
go ahead.
DigitalFoundry.net. And that is something that we are looking to revamp in the future and do a lot more with. So right now, you get 4K, you know, high quality versions of all the videos, the direct files, but there's more coming soon.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. I'll leave links for all of that stuff in the show notes as well. So check out John Dark1X and check out the Patreon Digital Foundry videos. They're doing some really cool stuff right now with Stadia. So check out those cool Stadia videos. Yeah. we could talk like another 2 hours about Stadia, but we'll leave it here for today. Yeah. Thank you so much, man, for coming on, and enjoy the rest of your day. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks. Sounds great.